Today, we're talking with Tom Singer. Tom is an executive search consultant for corporation and trade associations. He is also a keynote speaker and MC. Tom spent 30 years as a catalyst for human connections and an advisor to executives. I am your host, Zachary Alexander, subscription service designer at subscriptionmaker.net. Please hit the subscribe button wherever you get your podcast so that you won't miss any new episodes. The reason we are talking with Tom is because connections are a driving force behind retention. It's hard to convince subscribers to stick around unless you can find ways to connect with them, to show them the benefit that they will receive. Tom, welcome to the Subscription Maker Podcast.
Hey, Zachary, thank you so much for having me.
What does it mean to be a catalyst for human connections?
So I've spent the last 12 years of my career as a professional speaker, trainer, and coach, helping organizations and individuals really look at why people matter. I mean, let's face it, all opportunities in life come from people. But as we've looked for automation and systems and just the busy world that we've become through all the technology and social media, there has been a huge disconnect over the past decade. So my role is to help people really get back to basics when it comes to connecting with people.
How did you get started?
Oh, wow. I had a sales and marketing job for a long time. I worked for several different professional services type companies. And when you're in sales and marketing, you go to a lot of conferences. And so what happened to me was I would go to these conferences, and I can remember sitting in the audience in like those hotel room, conference room chairs, watching the speaker on stage and thinking, wow, she or he, they have a better job than I do. And so I decided I wanted to do that. So I started studying the business of speaking and training and coaching. And 12 years ago, I went full-time doing that. And up until the pandemic, that was the whole focus of my career.
Would you give our listeners a couple of tips on how to become a better catalyst, a better connection catalyst?
Yeah, I mean, it's all really simple stuff. Like sometimes when I work with people, they go, well, that's not rocket science. My grandmother told me that. But it's really taking an interest in people, showing up on time, following up with people, and also being the person who helps other people succeed. Zig Ziglar said it best many decades ago, and that was, you can have anything you want in this world if you just help others get what they want in this world. But I've watched over my lifetime, people get less and less concerned with helping others and more about tweeting, buy my stuff, sign up for my stuff, do my stuff. And so when you can take it backwards, you stand out a lot because if you're helping others, they'll notice.
Yeah, what I tend to find with people who are on Twitter is that it's seldom a social media site. They don't see the social part of it. It's more of a broadcast media. So they think that it's great to just go out and blast out. You know, I've connected with people who try to put something out every hour. And it's like, if you're putting stuff out every hour, you know that there's nobody sitting behind the tweet.
Well, and it used to be social media was very social. Facebook, Twitter, everything. And now it's really become, like you said, a broadcast tool. And I mean, I use it that way. Everybody does. But the reality is, I remember the early days of Twitter. I was on it in the first year. And I remember we would have tweet ups in cities. We'd be like, hey, we're going to a bar at 5 o'clock, and 50 people would show up. And I have friends to this day I met through Twitter, but I haven't met anyone via Twitter in probably close to a decade. So most social media has lost the social.
Please tell us a little bit about your speaking business.
So I've had what I called a traditional speaking business. I was a keynote speaker and master of ceremonies for corporations and associations. And my topic was, how do you connect with people in a gadget crazy world? I started my speaking business about the same time that the iPhone came out. And everybody thought, oh, now we can just click and tweet, you know, our way to relationships. And everybody thought association meetings, industry events, we're going to die off. But if you look at what happened over the past 10 or 12 years pre-pandemic, social and live events became more popular than they'd ever been in history. Because here's the thing, all of these tools we have, they're awesome, but they're just tools. A like, a link, a share, or a follow is not actually a friendship. You have to share experiences with people in order to bond with them. And we don't really share experiences over social media.
So tell us a little bit about how the pandemic, the lockdown has affected your business. Would you say it's made you more scrappy?
Scrappy is the word I use. My dad always used to say that, you know, get out there and be scrappy, figure it out, put the pieces together. And so, yeah, I mean, I call March 13th, 2020, the day my business died. I was scheduled to have my biggest year ever as a speaker and trainer that I'd had in 12 years of doing it full time. And over the course of the next several weeks after March 13th, I watched everything on my calendar for that next quarter, and then eventually for the rest of the year, just evaporate. Events were canceled, events were postponed, events moved virtual. And there wasn't as much for the virtual, there wasn't always as much of the same enthusiasm. Sometimes there wasn't as much of pay to be involved. And so one thing I did is I made it a plan starting about April 1st that I was going to talk to one really smart person every day in my industry and other industries, and ask them for advice, for help, for whatever. And I'll be honest, not everybody had a great idea. Some people had no ideas. But over the course of 6 months, I ended up with five or six opportunities that allowed me to piece together ways to make money as a virtual speaker. I got a couple of really good ideas that I put into practice. I started coaching again, which was something I did very rarely. And you know, currently I have 15 people who I'm helping with business development and some other career and life issues. And then I also went to work for an executive search firm, a company called Stanton Chase. It's one of the largest international executive search firms, helping mid-size and large companies place their C-level executives, directors, and VPs. And that business is all about human connection. I mean, the way you do executive search, you got to be able to connect with people. So I'm taking my lifetime of skills and putting it back into a professional services role.
Okay. So I'm going to get a little off topic here. I apologize. So how did you end up in Austin?
I ended up in Austin 30 years ago. And I grew up in Southern California. I went to college in San Diego. I was working in the Bay Area. And I got offered a job in Austin to manage a photography studio. I was working as a professional photographer for corporate events and high school proms and college events and graduations. And I got the opportunity to manage a similar type company in Austin, Texas. And I literally thought this would be fun for 3 years. And the young woman I was dating at the time said, "Oh my gosh, you know, I don't know if long distance will work. How is this going to happen?" And she went into the office and her boss handed her a flyer. This is 1991. So handed her a flyer, and it was her job for her company in Austin, Texas. And her boss said, "Are you interested?" And so we talked about it. And she said to me, "Are you asking me to marry you?" And I said, "No, I'm asking you to move to Texas." And we said we'd do it for three or four years. And we got here, we got married, we bought our first house, we had a couple children, and you know, Austin became one of the hottest cities in the country and has been ever since the early 90s. And so we've built a really nice life in Austin over 30 years. And so we kind of ended up here by accident. It was going to be a stopover. And then we thought we'd go back to San Diego, and we've been here ever since.
The reason I bring that up is I worked for a company that was based out of Austin. It was a company that did recruiting for high-tech people. So used to be this thing that you would kernel developers. So basically they went to Austin because IBM was looking for kernel developers. And they were like, "Well, we don't know any, and we don't even know what that term is, but we'll figure it out." And they went to Austin to recruit people for that. So I was always curious, how did you deal with all the techies running around Austin?
Well, I mean, if you can't beat them, you join them. So after I left the job that brought me here, I ended up going to work for the Chamber of Commerce. I sold advertising in a lot of their publications. And then I went to work for companies that were selling to the tech industry. So I worked for a couple different industries, but I worked in financial printing. I worked for a law firm. I worked for a consulting firm and a bank. And part of my job was to be part of the tech industry. Even though I sold services, you know, we were catering to all the startups that were popping up in the late 90s and early 2000s. So I dove right into that community.
Let's shift gears a little bit. What kind of challenges do you find working with large organizations?
Oh, well, I mean, whether it's my role in executive search or my role as a trainer or speaker, One of the hardest things about large organizations is getting in touch with the right person. You know, if I can get on the phone and talk to somebody who's looking for a product or a service that I'm selling, it's great because, you know, if you can talk to anybody, you can have that human connection, you at least can get them to take a look. And if they take a look and if they're really looking to purchase, you've got a shot. If you're on that short list, you know, because it doesn't matter what people are buying, if they're going to talk to two or three companies in an industry, if you're not one of the two or three people who gets to talk to the decision maker, you have a 0% chance of getting that business. So whether it's speaking at a sales kickoff, if the sales manager doesn't talk to me, I will not be the keynote speaker for that event. And whether it's recruiting, you know, the CFO or the CIO for a company that's growing and needs to have new talent in one of those super important roles, if I don't get a chance to talk to the decision maker, whether it's the CEO or the head of HR, if I don't get to talk to that decision maker, I have a 0% chance they're going to work with me. So the hardest thing is just getting people to take your call and have that initial conversation. Once you're in, you know, then you got a shot at winning the business.
What kind of challenges do you find working with small startups?
So for small startups, it's oftentimes sticker shock. They can't believe what a product or a service costs. Throughout my career, I've worked with a lot of startups. And, you know, I do a lot of training for startups. But, you know, if they've never hired someone to come in and do, you know, a training class for their sales team or to speak at their customer meeting, you know, wow, they're surprised at what that costs. Oftentimes the executives, they're not as surprised at the cost of executive search because they've probably been down that path if they're at that level as an executive themselves. But I think one of the hardest things is getting people to realize what professional services, regardless of it's law, accounting, consulting, you know, what the actual cost is. And so sticker shock gets the small companies sometimes.
How do you get companies and people you coach to make the small changes to get the ball rolling?
So when I work with teams or individuals, I use the Socratic method, for lack of a better term. I ask a lot of questions. And what I want to discover is I want to discover what are the roadblocks, because we all have them. I suffer from them all the time. When I look at you know, I kind of have these two career paths. When I look at what's holding me back in either one, a lot of it has to do with my own personal mindset. Maybe I haven't done something before. For me personally, I find that once I've done something one time, I can do it 10 times. But if I have to change directions, kind of believing in myself that I can do that is the first hurdle. And so my trick is to ask a lot of questions and find out where the person stands on the issues that are holding them back. And oftentimes just talking it out is the first step to getting people to move forward down that path.
Okay. So what does the phrase compounding generosity mean to you?
Wow. Did you watch my TED talk?
So,
I did a TEDx. You pulled out that phrase. I'm like, I know where that comes from. I had the honor to do a TEDx talk. Gosh, I guess 2 years ago, maybe three. And the title of the talk is called The Art of Giving Small. And it's all about the fact that you don't have to be rich to have a real impact on a charity. And I tell the story about how we started giving a little bit of my speaking income, just tiny little percentage point, every time I gave a speech. And over 12 years, and through some donations from some clients and some donations from some friends, it added up to a really big amount. So I call it compounded generosity, because it's a lot like compounded interest. You know, we teach younger people to start saving for retirement when they're young, because that compounding interest and the growth of the stocks that they invest in over time, you know, it grows so much more when it has a longer window to do it. And so many people think, well, I have to wait till I'm rich to give to a charity. But the reality is, if you gave, you know, a small amount every month or every time you had a sale over 12 years, in my case, it's added up to $70,000 or maybe $80,000 that's been donated to the charity that we chose. I couldn't write a check for that much money. If I walked into any charity and said, here's $80,000, they'd probably take me to dinner. However, I did it in $50 checks, $25 checks, $100 checks, over what has now been 12 years. So I call it compounded generosity, because you just need to make it part of your lifestyle, just like saving for retirement.
Okay, so you are the only person, or the first person, who is a father-daughter TEDx speaker.
I'm sure there are others.
I mean, you two have done something that a lot of people, a lot of professionals, you know, wait a lifetime to do. So what was that process like to you?
So what Zachary is referring to is I'm the father of two daughters, and my youngest daughter, who is now 19 years old, when she was 15, gave a TEDx talk at a TEDx youth program in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And she would tell you if she was here, she's now a freshman in college. She would tell you if she was here, she gave a TEDx talk before I gave one. I had applied for several years wanting to, like you said, many people desire to do that. I had wanted to do it. I had wanted to tell the story of the compounded generosity and the art of giving small. And I just wasn't selected for whatever reason. Groups didn't pick me. And she applied one time. We had heard my older daughter was going to college in Pittsburgh, and she had been the head of TEDx Carnegie Mellon University. And one of the speakers that she had worked with, who had become friends, that speaker's son was putting on a TEDx youth program, and they were looking for teenagers. And my daughter, my 15-year-old, was like, I'll apply. And I said, what are you going to talk about? What would you apply? She goes, you know how I don't listen to you and mom, and I just do my own thing. I sort of go my own way. Rather, I don't listen to my teachers or my friends. I just follow my heart. And I'm like, yes, as your parent, I'm very aware of that. So she delivered a TEDx talk called Go Your Own Way. And it's all about how teenagers, while you need to follow certain rules, you don't want to necessarily be boxed in by society. And she told her story of her life dream and what she's going to do with that. So 6 months later, I had the opportunity to do a TEDx talk. And so if she was here, she would tell you she did it first.
What advice would you give someone who was considering doing a TEDx talk?
Wow. I mean, the list is so long. It is such an honor to be chosen to speak on a TEDx stage, whether it's a small one or a larger one. And the one thing you need to do is you need to take it seriously. Now, I had a little bit of an advantage that I'm a professional speaker who at that time had given over 800 professional presentations. Most people who do TEDx talks don't have that level of speaking skills. They say that the talks that do the best, that get the most views, that get spread, usually the person who did it, it's not that they were a professional. In fact, most aren't. It's that they invested 40 to 60 hours of rehearsal. And I'll be honest, I put more time into that TEDx talk than just about anything I've ever done as far as actual number of times I rehearsed it, because I had one shot at it. You know, you don't get to do those things very often. I know some people who've done 2, 3, or 4, but that is extremely rare. And you know, would I want to do another one? Sure. Am I banking that it's going to happen? No. So it was a one-shot deal. And so you have to put in the time and hire a coach. I hired a speaking coach to help me prepare for that, even though, you know, I'm a fairly good speaker, but I still hired someone who knew that stage, who understood TEDx.
Okay. So I'm going to backtrack a little bit. What was it like to pivot your business?
Well, I'm still in the middle of it, right? We're 11 months into the big pivot, and I spent the first 2 weeks wanting to curl up in a ball and cry. But as we said earlier, I'm scrappy. And so I really had to just start looking for ideas. And, you know, I don't recommend all businesses at all times just keep throwing spaghetti at the wall to see what sticks, but that's what I've had to do. And so it's scary. I watched what was a pretty decent planned income for 2020 fall to almost zero. And quarter two and quarter three, I didn't make very much money. I did not make enough money to keep my lifestyle going. I had to dip into my savings. And I had worked really hard to have 6 months of savings. And I spent most of it in 6 months. And so that was really painful. It'll take me a long time probably to build that back up. And so you just have to face the hard. You can't sit in a ball and cry in the corner, and you just got to keep trying things. And I'm still trying things. I'm still looking for ways. I get excited when someone calls and wants me to coach them, even if they don't fall into the box of what I normally do, because if I can work with somebody and help them, then I push myself. Taking this new job, going to work for the executive search firm, it had been 12 years since I've worked for another company, and getting back into being inside a company culture, although I work remotely, you know, having meetings, having to jump on Microsoft Teams, It was a shift for me, but it's been exciting. It turns out it's the best company I've ever worked for, culture-wise and how helpful everybody is. But I get paid versus based on what I do. So I've got to get out and shake the tree, just like owning my own business as a speaker. If I don't sell it, I don't get a paycheck. And so I've got to get out there and meet people and ask questions. And I think that's a good point. I think asking a lot of questions of everybody is the only way that you can pivot through what we've been through the last year.
I think one of the things that I've found in talking to people about their pivots is just how long it takes. I mean, it's easy and quick to figure out that you need to pivot. I mean, sometimes it just slaps you upside the head and you know, okay, I need to make a change. But the actual time to move a company from one path to another to pivot can take 2 years. I mean, I've talked people who say, yeah, it took me 2 years. You know, I figured it out right away. Oh, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. But to get to move my company, the people who worked for me, to get my team on board, to get my customers on board, so they said that was a 2-year process. So that brings me to the question I really wanted to ask you. What was the best advice you ever received about pivoting?
Wow. I mean, there's been a lot of advice that I've gotten. And so I think the best advice that I've really got through that, like I said, I talk to one smart person every day. And I think the best piece of advice I got was, you know, keep reaching out to people. It was reminding me of what I've been teaching for over a decade. And that was all opportunities in life come from people. The way you're going to get a lead to get that next keynote, the way you're going to get the lead to be able to do that search for that large company, it's going to come from somebody who puts you on that short list. And so, you know, hiding away from people, as we've been sort of forced to do, right? We've been asked to socially distance. And so I took on this whole concept of let's socially tighten while we're socially distancing. And so I participate in things like the Association for Corporate Growth. We have a great chapter in Austin and San Antonio, and they do really good networking events in the cities all across the country. And so I sign up and I go to those and I listen to their speakers. But then when they do the breakout rooms where they send you in Zoom out to little groups of 3 and 4, I really try to have conversations and see if there's someone there I can find a win-win connection with. You don't have that with everybody. But when you can find a connection, people want to open doors for you. I mean, that's the biggest thing I've found is people want to help me. And so it's just a matter of talking to enough people and at the same time, being willing to help them. You can't be so freaked out about your own situation that you don't take the time to connect the dots for the other person that you met. So I think the best advice was keep it up and just keep talking to people. Eventually, you're going to find the path.
As we start to wrap up, Tom, is there a question you wish more people would ask you?
I don't know. I get asked a lot of questions. I wish people for the side of my speaking business, I wish more people would ask, you know, like who they could introduce me to, because it's really all about that. It's when people are planning meetings virtually, in person, or hybrid. Again, if I can get on the short list, if they can have a conversation, I got a shot at it. And I guess for my executive search side, it's the same thing. It's can I meet the executives in companies? Can I meet the investors and the advisors and the venture capitalists? If people would ask, who could I introduce you to a little bit more? Because I don't like to call people and go, hi, Zachary, this is Tom. We haven't talked in a while. Could you introduce me to Mary Beth? You know, that's kind of a taker type thing. So if more people who, you know, I try to ask people all the time, what can I do for you? And I think that if more people ask that question, we'd all win more.
Okay, so you've got 2 daughters. How do you teach respect for entrepreneurship?
Oh, wow. You ask tough questions, Zachary. I hope it's by example. My wife works for herself. She's an independent contractor and she runs an association. She does consulting for a group, but at the end of the day, she controls her own schedule, does her own thing. I've worked for myself for much of my children's life, not all of my children's life. And they realized that I traveled a lot. As a speaker, I was gone 100 nights a year. And I always worried about my relationship with the kids. And one of them told me one time, you're gone a lot, but when you're home, you're home. And they came to realize that while they didn't like me being away from them, and I didn't necessarily like being away, that was how I got the money that bought the toys. And so they realized that was just the way my job worked. So I hope I taught them respect for entrepreneurship by being one and at the same time being super connected to them. I like to believe I have a really good relationship with both of my daughters. They're both super fine women. I was not much of an academic when I was in high school or college, and both of them were, you know, top of their class and went to Ivy League or Ivy League Plus, they call it, sort of the top schools. They both went to great institutions, and I never pushed them to do that. They were both very self-driven, but I was super proud of the fact that they set their sights on, you know, going to top colleges and did the work. And I think that I like to think they learned that from my wife and I through the actions that we took, that when things get tough, you roll up your sleeves and you do the work. But I will tell you a secret. I love having adult children. My children are 19. One is a college freshman and 23. One is a college graduate, and she's engaged to be married and starting her own life. And I really like adult children. I like the relationship that I have with them at all stages, but I love the relationship now where we can call and just talk about stuff.
Now, you've talked about being scrappy. Is there something you can tell us about, some offering that you can talk about, some new offering that you can talk about with us now?
Yeah. So one of the things I did in my own life is when I turned 50, I made a big pledge that I was going to make age 50 to 75 the best years of my life. And people stopped me and said, "What does that even mean? You've had a pretty good life. You know, what are you saying? The best years of your life? That's a big challenge." And I just decided I was going to get out of my own way. I was going to learn to say yes more. And now I've been asked by people who are about to turn 50 if I do life coaching. And I'd never done that before, but I'm being scrappy. I'm rolling up my sleeves. And I'm like, first person who asked me that, I'm like, "Well, yes, what are you looking for?" And, you know, so now, as you know, I'm living this, I'm 5 years past that proclamation. My motto is try new things. And so I've been trying things in business and outside of business for 5 years that I might've never done before. A couple of examples is I used to weigh 30 pounds more and I took up running. I'd never been an athlete. I took up running. I ran a half marathon and then I ran a second half marathon. And along the way, I lost 30 pounds. I scared of heights. And the first thing I did right around the time I turned 50 was I jumped off the Stratosphere in Las Vegas. They have this outside 108 story jump that you can do. And I'll be honest, I was scared to death. But I did it, which allowed me then to go zip lining when I was in Costa Rica, where before I might've been like, "Oh, I'm too scared." And so, you know, there's that. And then the biggest one was 3 years ago, no, two, 3 years ago, I was going to be in New York City, and a professional speaker friend of mine, who's also a professional comic, invited me to go to open mic night with him. And I said, "Oh, I love comedy. I'd love to watch you work on new material." And he said, "That's not what I'm inviting you to do." And he invited me to write a comedy set and go to a comedy club and do 5 minutes on stage. And I was like, "Oh no." And then he said, "Aren't you the guy who teaches try new things?" And I was like, "Dang it. I hate it when people throw my own teaching back at me." And so I did it and I had such a good time, and it wasn't great. You know, I always joke that Jerry Seinfeld is not worried about job security because I did stand-up comedy. But then I started going to open mic nights all over the country when I would travel, because they were usually like 9 o'clock at night. I would be done with my work for the conference, and I would do them. And I ended up, before the pandemic hit, I did 95 comedy open mic nights at bars, restaurants, coffee shops, and comedy clubs, you know, all over the United States. I did 95 of them, and I was invited to do a couple of local comedy shows. And again, I'm not great. I got better, but it was really challenging to do something way out of my comfort zone. And so now I'm coaching other people who are looking at, "Hey, 50 isn't old. What can I do to try new things?" And so that's kind of a fun little offering. I don't really advertise it, but if people are looking for that, I'm scrappy. And I say, "Well, yes, we can work this out."
So what's the best way to follow you on social media?
I'm everywhere, and I'm on Tom Singer, Thomsinger, on social media. I'm on, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, Clubhouse, you know, many places like that. And then my main way to find me is on my website, which is just tomsinger.com.
Tom, thank you so much for joining us on the Subscription Maker podcast.
Oh, thank you. I mean, you ask a lot of questions kind of all over the board. You made me think, and that is a good sign for a great interviewer.
Thank you so much. This is your host, Zachary Alexander, subscription service designer at subscriptionmaker.net. Please join us next time as we talk about what it takes to be a successful subscription maker.